Welcome, everybody. Welcome to quite a packed episode, actually. I skipped last week, but this episode has got a lot in it. We have an interview with Michael Guerin and Martine Dowden, another pair of Manning authors, and we're talking about their forthcoming book for Manning called Tiny CSS. And that was a nice interview about a book that I think would be quite positive for many of you learning CSS or wanting to relearn some techniques, that kind of thing. I have a few mentions of some things I've been up to. And of course, I have some links. Let's get started with those links first. First, a little bit of Apple coverage. This is from Sean Hollister on The Verge. It's been widely reported. I still have to check if this is applicable all over the world or if it's just in the US, in which case it's semi-useful. Has, I think, bowed to pressure and finally got on with this partial self-fix program. And this article goes into a little bit of detail about the parts and how much they're going to cost. And actually, it amazed me because some of them were surprisingly low, I guess, and some of them were surprisingly expensive. I suppose it somewhat depends on whether it's custom or kind of mass manufactured. So things like, for example, the antenna module, I guess, for the Wi-Fi, I suppose. It's the only antenna there is, or maybe it's Bluetooth, I'm not sure. $15 for every model. Similar with the audio board, $12. Again, I'm not sure what that means because I thought with the different versions of MacBooks, there's been improvements to the audio jack and things like that. So I would have expected to be differences there, although this isn't all models. I think it's only some older models. So again, this is Apple's attempt to have a self-repair program, but it's a very Apple self-repair program. And then we get to the more nuance here. So batteries, for example, you can't replace every battery. Battery cover, you can, which is weird. And one costs 50 cents more for some strange reason. The display is where the costs start to vary quite a lot, I guess, depending on the Retina, whether it's an Air, whether it's a Pro, that kind of thing. Where we get into the really expensive part is, of course, the logic board. This is the meat and potatoes of most computers. And it varies quite a lot. So, for example, I guess from low end to high end, the most expensive is the 14-inch MacBook Pro from 2021, which is what I have, ranging from $878 to nearly $4,000, $3,958. Mine is probably somewhere in the middle of that. And those are similar ranges for all of them, I guess, depending on the amount of options. So something like the Airs, for example, that have less options, have less of a range. It's also interesting because it says $499.84 after credit. I don't really know what that means or how that works exactly. And then the other expensive parts are the top casing. A lot of the casing these days is all inclusive. You'll often find that if you damage a small thing, you have to replace the whole case. And that's basically the two main costs. So the comment here is interesting, is most prices seem relatively generous, others not so much, which is kind of what I said. If you need to replace the logic board, you might as well get a new laptop in some respects, although it'd have to do the cost there. If you just need to replace the antenna, then great, $15, that's fine. This doesn't really go into any of the instructions on how it's done, of course, and how easy it is to replace these things. Maybe that $15 antenna is incredibly hard to replace. And there's another interesting one, like, for example, if you break a key on the keyboard, you have to get an entire new layout. You can't just get one. And let's dig a little bit into the motherboard, because that's where things get a bit more interesting, the logic board. So firstly, you can't upgrade it. You can't swap a lower-end one for a higher-end one, which seems odd. I don't really see why not. Maybe there's other reasons. And they incentivize you to return it. So this is where the voucher comes from. So actually, for a 16-inch MacBook Pro board, you will only end up paying $588. So I guess they have a way of repurposing them, repairing them maybe. Maybe they recycled them somehow. Maybe those valuable metals inside end up being worth doing this for. So it's interesting as well. And then there's even prices for the tools. I think this was something that was mentioned when people were first testing this, how you get shipped this ridiculous toolbox that takes a long time and you have to send back and there's all this shipping, and you really get to this point where you're like, is this worth it for Apple? But whatever, that's fine. And it's a, yeah, it's a rental, $49 for that. So I hope I never have to test this. I haven't really needed to repair any aspect of a MacBook for some time, not since probably the keyboard, old Butterfly keyboards, the first generation Butterfly keyboards, where I just got the whole thing replaced for free, of course. That's the only time I've had to have anything repaired in quite some time. So hopefully I will never need to test this. And but there's a little bit of interesting there. And it's, I guess the TLDR is, it's not as bad as you may think. Another little bit of Apple news here. This is coming back to a series of posts written by someone I've mentioned a few times on the podcast now, the Eclectic Light Company. He actually published a whole series of blog posts recently, which fed very nicely into the Virtual Buddy video I made recently, which I think I told you all about how virtualization works on Apple Silicon Macs. This is generally around virtualizing for macOS virtual machines, so for testing and things like that. Something like Parallels definitely does both, and I use Parallels for Windows machines definitely. But Virtual Buddy, in fact, he goes through a lot of the options here. Virtual Buddy, UTM, Viable, even VMware Fusion are largely for macOS images. So for testing betas, if you're a developer, et cetera, these sorts of things. But new frameworks inside Monterey and Big Sur have made this easier, which is, I guess, why there's now this proliferation of these tools. And in quote marks, in very large quote marks, they're relatively easy to develop, I suppose, is the argument here. So there's a lot of discussion around how the file formats work, how the underlying infrastructure works, how they compare, all these sorts of things. So this is a topic I really love to find out more about, and I wish I'd known more about it before I made the video. And actually, I left a comment on the post and he mentioned this. But if that also interests you, and why should it not, then go and take a look. And finally, this is an article from MIT Technology Review from Clive Thompson. It's actually from nearly a year ago, but it's come up recently, I think, because the company have been heavily crippled by the supply line issues, and thus, because they're such a fundamental part of the supply process themselves, this, I think, just news about them has resurfaced. So this is called Inside the Machine That Saved Moore's Law. The Dutch firm, it's nice that it's not in America or Asia, ASML spent $9 billion and 17 years developing a way to keep making denser computer chips and get around this kind of Moore's Law issue that has popped up over the past few years, where for various sort of thermal, physical, chemical reasons, it's almost impossible to build anything that can go higher than what we have now. And there've been alternative methods have been needed, and this is a machine that does that. So they actually do have a factory in the States as well, and this is where the interview comes from. One machine can cost $180 million, and companies like Intel and TSMC buy them. Each machine is assembled in the Netherlands. It's the size of a small bus. And what it does is it... in a very overarching way, it blasts molten drops of tin with lasers 50,000 times a second, and it takes 4 747s to ship one to a customer. You can start to see where these prices are. I've actually been reading a book recently called When Wizards Stay Up Late, which is about the creation of ARPANET, the precursor to the internet, and it's somewhat similar in they often had like babysitters on planes with the machines that were set up as the initial node in that network. And they were very, if you think of a rugged laptop these days, these things were like, could withstand bomb damage, which was kind of the point. And there's some wonderful photos and wonderful descriptions here of how it all works. And you can see this machine, it does even have wheels from the looks of it. and actually moving parts of the machinery around. And how they got to it and the story from there. So I will leave you to read it in a bit more detail because it's a little bit older. It's outside the MIT Technology Review paywall, so go and have a read and marvel at these awesome photos of crazy machinery making probably some of the chips you are using right now. Now I'm going to move into something a little different. People have asked me many times to look at software products, even some hardware products that relate to technology, but generally not much else. That's kind of what I tend to cover. But I actually got sent something else to test, which I'm going to cover. It's been quite busy for me the past few months and probably the next couple of weeks as well. I'm sort of in a transition phase with work. I'm going to start spending more time on some of my creative projects in the coming months, but I'm in that transition period where timing, you couldn't quite get it to work out. I've got to do a lot at the moment and trying to struggle to remember all these things, but also, you know, preparing for these creative ideas I'm really enthusiastic about working on very soon. I think my biggest problem is this frustration of not having enough time to get to them all. And then because of all these things I want to do, I'm often quite unfocused and find it hard to fit everything in a constructive, productive way. I've been trying this little drink. It came from America. It got stuck in German customs for a while, which is always fun. Called Magic Mind. And it packs a whole bunch of ingredients in to try and help with some of these things and some things I didn't necessarily need help with, but hey, everything's a bonus. And I've been trying it over the past 7 days. I'm about halfway through now, so it seemed to be a good time to talk through it. If you're interested actually in watching my experiences with it on a day-to-day basis, I'm also putting together a video on YouTube, on my YouTube channel. I have been a lot more, my sleep has still been a little bit up and down. It takes a little bit of time to repair, I think, because sometimes it's other things going on that you need to fix. But I've definitely been kind of more level. I've found that my energy has been more balanced over the day. And I tend to get up quite early and I tend to stay out reasonably late. And I like to pack a lot in to my days. This is my just the way I like to be. I like to be busy. I like to make the most of my life as much as possible. But I have found that I'm getting kind of more done evenly spread out through the day. It's hard to obviously say what is helping because there's a bunch of different ingredients in here. But the one that maybe I will call out, Bacopa Monnieri, it's a nootropic. And it has actually claimed to be one of the things it can help with is something like procrastination. It's helped me procrastinate less or be more focused around it and with it. If that, I feel like there is some form of focus procrastination. And if any of this sounds familiar to you, or you'd like to, of course, see if there's any other benefits that might benefit you, have a look at it. Give it a try. They do ship around the world, actually. I have a couple of discount codes you can try if that interests you. So for the next 10 days after the release of this episode, you can get 40% off a subscription at a special link I have, which is magicmind.co/chinchilla, C-H-I-N-C-H-I-L-L-A, or you can get a 20% discount on any single purchase with the code chinchilla20, C-H-I-N-C-H-I-L-L-A, 20, number 20. And I will report back on sort of the end of my experiences with it next episode, and watch out for that video too. And now to my interview with Michael Guerin and Martin Dowden and their forthcoming book from Manning, Tiny CSS Projects.
So I'm Martin Dowden. I'm a UX UI developer by trade. I'm now the CTO for Andromeda Galactic Solutions, and I've been doing this for a while now. And CSS is probably my favorite coding language.
Okay. Yep.
Yep. And so I'm Mike, UX sort of front end developer, living in Wales in the UK. So my background is like in interaction design, front end development, and at the moment working in the UK government, looking at the digital services.
Firstly, Martin, what was the name of that company? It sounded like Intergalactic Solutions, but I'm not sure if that's what I heard.
Andromeda Galactic Solutions. Okay, yeah, that is what you heard.
So how did someone working for the UK government and someone working for the government of Andromeda, I'm not sure, how did the two of you meet and decide to do this book in the first place?
We met through Manning.
Okay.
Manning and paired us up.
Okay.
Go ahead, Michael.
Basically, the idea of the book, I initially started writing about the book. We went working with Manon, we were kind of planning our chapters, and we started writing some of the chapters, and Martin was kind of working on a separate project with Manon. And Manon just thought, hang on a minute, we got kind of two similar projects going on here. Can we kind of do a collaboration for the Times CSS Projects book? And I think it's gone really well so far. We're coming in from different perspectives, as you sort of mentioned, that we've got two completely different backgrounds, but I think that's lending itself well to this book.
Okay. And so let's talk about the name, Tiny CSS. I was wondering, because when I first saw it, I've been quite interested recently in understanding ways of reducing the environmental impact of applications. And front end is actually, I think the front end community is way ahead in this regard. I think probably because it's easier to observe what's going on. So initially I thought, oh, tiny CSS, does that mean reducing CSS, or does it mean manageable CSS? So yeah, what do you mean, or what does the title mean by tiny CSS? What kind of angle are you going for there?
So the concept of the book is quite a nice simple proposition, in the sense that each chapter has got its own individual project. It's a tiny project, and the idea is that you start with a problem or something that you want to tackle, and by the end of that chapter, you've achieved that objective. And then by going through each chapter, not only are you just building these tiny projects, you're also learning CSS in the background. And it's very much led by a project-led basis, but you also got the benefit of learning CSS as a language.
Okay. So tiny in this case is manageable. What's the actionable, manageable, all the ABLES projects to learn techniques from? Yeah? Okay. And where do you think people reading the book would be at in their CSS experience career? Is this for beginners, intermediate, advanced, or across the board?
I think this is one of the trickier things that we had conversations with, is CSS can be a useful language for so many different people. A back-end developer might need to sort of dip into CSS to make front-end changes. Someone who's new to front-end development, is kind of an essential language for them to pick up. And how we kind of landed our thoughts on this was that it's a bit for everything. If you want it in that sense, that you could be a new person to CSS, and this could be a nice introduction to that because it's got that tiny approach. But at the same time, it's also suitable for those developers who kind of dip into CSS as well.
When it came to picking the projects, how did you decide what to pick? CSS is a big topic. It's been with us for some time. It's always changing. So how did you, the two of you, decide what you were going to choose for those 12 projects?
Martin, would you like to go first?
Sure. I think there's some level of we tried to balance the fundamentals that you had, like things that if you're going to write CSS that you probably are going to need at some point. And then things that are really commonly used, and then things that are tricky and you wouldn't like, or like that obscure helpful thing. So when you take all three of those, it's coming up with projects that are day in, day out, things you would see in the wild that you would come up against in the wild that you would actually do. And then figuring out how to work in the helpful things and the core fundamentals in there, as well as those little tidbits of, oh, you know, it's actually super easy to do this. Here's the 2.5 lines of code you'll need, right?
Okay. Yeah. Were there any disagreements between topics?
No, not really.
There's a couple chapters we went round and round as to how to put it together. Like in terms of like which concept would be best suited, but for the most part, not really.
Yeah. And as two people who have not really worked together before, Have you just basically taken a chapter each, or have you collaborated on chapters?
Pretty much. So that's the approach we've gone for, is that Martin is tackling six chapters, I'm also tackling the other six chapters, a nice fair split in that way. But then we're kind of making sure we got that consistency across the book. So once we've kind of written like a first draft version, we're just like, hey, can you just go and kind of check in and have a little look at this? And I think that's just like an amazing feat of technology in that sense, that Martin's over in America, I'm over in the UK. We've been using Slack and Google Docs and all of those sort of things just to help us with that collaboration.
And what did you decide? CSS is one of these technologies, I already said, it's been around for a while. I think I remember when it came out. That's how long I've been dabbling in web technologies. And to many in the front-end community, it's almost, they almost don't touch it anymore. They're using different levels of abstraction to do CSS, you know. So what did you decide to leave out? What could you have done that you decided doesn't really suit the topic, or is too many levels of abstraction, or et cetera, et cetera?
Oh, we went down to the bare bones. We went back to pure old plain CSS, which is not like it would, a lot of times today, you'll be using either Sass or Less or, you know, whatever, pick your, or you'll be using Tailwinds or Materials or, you know, and then there's all those layers on top. We went down to the bare bones CSS because if we went from the principle that if you understand CSS, you can build and abstract to any of those layers. But if you don't understand the core underline, it's going to be really easy to make mistakes that'll shoot you in the foot long down the road with all of those various pieces. And so that even when the other thing is, well, if we're going to go Sass versus Less, like which syntax and you get into all of these questions of, well, now we have to present the framework and explain the framework, when realistically, it still boils down to, if you're trying to troubleshoot the issue with any of those, you know, preprocessors and frameworks, you're still going to come back down to how does CSS itself work. Mm. So that's why we went with the more of the, let's just come all the way down to the base level. And the last chapter is going to cover preprocessors, but at a very, very high level in terms of, here are your options. Mm. Here's, you know. But we wanted the majority of the book to stay really, really pure to CSS, so that you could, because then, I mean, as a developer, we're used to abstracting after that, but to really stick to those core concepts.
Mm. I get a feeling there's I sort of saw a feeling there of maybe you're sometimes a little professionally offended that so many people don't really understand the basics when they are dabbling at higher levels.
No, I don't think professionally offended is the right term. I think it's doing yourself a disservice to, if you're going to play with the frameworks and if you're going to play with all of the preprocessors and stuff, at some point you're doing yourself a disfavor if you don't learn CSS.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And that's where I think, you can get very, very far knowing just Tailwinds on Sass or whatever, or something like that. You can get quite far. But I think that some of the griping and some of the complaints I hear a lot about CSS can be very quickly related to not understanding some piece of the core fundamentals versus the fact that it actually sucks. Mm. You know, there's a lot of people that'll just say CSS sucks, and it really doesn't. It just needs, you know, time to be understood. That's all.
Yeah. I also kind of get the impression that CSS and vanilla JavaScript have both actually improved massively and added a lot of things that all these other tools added in the meantime, but people don't touch them so much, they don't actually realize they can do these things with the vanilla options now. It's actually something that often delightfully surprises me every now and then.
Correct.
Yeah.
And then in that sense, CSS has come on a long way, especially in the last couple of years. You've now got CSS grids and Flexbox and all of this really useful stuff, where in the past you would have a framework to kind of get your way around it to sort of be able to do a nice layout. But actually, it's pretty simple. Once you know the core basics of how to do a grid, you can quickly develop quite nice layouts with just pure CSS.
We're seeing a lot of that same transition we saw that JavaScript went through when you started seeing things like you don't need jQuery, right? Because the basics to the bottom line was everything pulled back down to jQuery, because so many and Lodash or underscore or those kind of libraries, and now so much of that is just baked into the language. We're seeing a lot of that with CSS, where a lot of the things where we used to use either a combination of CSS and JavaScript, or we're going to use, you know, pre-made classes because writing it was such a pain. That's kind of going away. Yeah. And so we're slowly seeing that shift we saw happen with jQuery and JavaScript happening with the world of CSS, or at least that's where I hope things are going.
And I can see that because you've included things like animation, which I think has been possible with CSS for a while, but I actually get the feeling a lot of people don't realize it's been possible.
Browser support was the holdup on that for a long time.
Oh, those are the days. So, what going outside of these 12 topics? What's exciting you about the world of CSS at the moment? What's on the horizon that really excites the two of you? Let's start with Michael.
So, I really like the look of subgrids. Which is an extension of where CSS with grids has come from. So subgrids is going to be really interesting to see how it kind of takes that layout, making it easy to lay out items a bit a step further. I think that's particularly interesting. I'm looking forward to also like CSS variables. I think that's quite an interesting topic. And that kind of goes into like SAS and all of those ones where you can start to create variables that you can reuse through your CSS. And there's a whole area around there. And I think the third thing I'm looking forward to seeing a bit more is like functions. So we start to see things like the ability to functions and colors. You know, it looks, those are the two areas I think are looking quite interesting. The idea of using a function to like improve the contrast or to do those sort of things, which wasn't possible that long ago, but actually it's starting to look more and more like a thing that is going to come about quite quickly.
And how about you, Martin?
That's funny because your list is completely different than mine. I'm more looking at some of the new selectors, has and where I think are going to be incredibly powerful really, really quickly. And then things like we may actually be getting a loss of line. I was just following a thread about that, which would be super cool. So a lot of the new selectors that just allow for a lot more complex things, I think will be super cool. And then some of the improvements that have been done on forms and just what you can do with styling forms, because they're everywhere. I mean, absolutely bloody everywhere. So I think that one is those are interesting to me because when's the last time I wrote a website or an application that did not have at least one, right? If nothing else, it's got a contact form.
I can't remember who wrote this, but there was a blog post recently from someone saying that the form killed the internet. It basically turned it into being e-commerce everywhere and this kind of thing. I can't remember where I read it. It was quite a recent blog post, if you can find it. But do you worry that with these extra things getting added in and it's starting to become more like some of those frameworks that the barrier to entry is going to be too complicated, or are those basics still there as well?
I mean, if we look at Angular, or the progression of Angular, from AngularJS to today, like it's radically changed, right? And it's what the code that you would have written in AngularJS wouldn't work in an Angular application today. And CSS doesn't have that problem. The code we wrote 10 years ago still works and would still work. Now we have access to a bunch more stuff, but you can still write a float and it'll still just work just fine. you could still technically, although not advisable, lay something out in a table with spacer images, and it will still beautifully work, right? So I think it's one of those where the barrier to entry is kind of still the same it always was. The only difference is that there's more to pick from and get confused by and overwhelmed by more than anything else. But like it's still the same thing. It's still the same, like the core principles of selectors, those are still the same. Inheritance is still the same. All of those, you know, insert CSS word soup here, those things are still the same, right? So I don't think it's that. I think it's going to be the same problem it's always been. And I think we're going to see this more of the same problems we've always had is how do you select the right thing at the right time and don't resort to important? Like, yeah. It's still going to be the same old battle.
How about you, Michael?
Yeah, no, I don't think the barrier is getting higher the more CSS develops. I think more of the risk is the more frameworks and those side of things there are, and a less understanding of knowledge of the core CSS. I think that's more of a problem, especially for junior developers who might pick up a project that's got CSS over the top of CSS and not really understanding the cascade of how that CSS is working, those core principles. I think that's more of a barrier to entry, is picking up existing style sheets and existing projects. As Martine said, like the core principles of CSS is still the same. It's just being developed on. And I think that's the better approach than introducing another framework or another extension to CSS.
It's actually something I think is often forgotten about. The C is cascading, and once you understand it, it's actually quite wonderful, but it can take some time to get your head around that.
One, so many frameworks break it. Like if we look at, I'm not going to name names because everybody has their pet library, but there are a number of frameworks that basically break inheritance and cascade by putting all of the classes in the HTML without any concept of that. And I think that makes it harder to learn how CSS works if you're used to one of those frameworks.
Okay, final question before we just wrap up with where people can find more about the book and the two of you. What's your favorite CSS feature aspect, or which is the one you think people should know the most? There might not be the same answer. Who would like to go first?
It's a tricky
Michael,
one.
You go first because I'm still thinking.
I think he is.
I was about to say the same thing. I think it is the core understanding of CSS. I think remembering back to when I first learned about CSS, I think it's around understand like the selectors and like starting to dig into like how the fundamentals are. I think anything else on top of that is great and it's good to know about, like grid, flexbox, etc. But for me, I think the most value, and it always will be, is just the fundamentals. And it sounds quite dry, but I think it's definitely underappreciated and undervalued.
Are you ready, Martine?
Yeah, maybe. It'll be my favorite today. Tomorrow I may have a different favorite based on what I'm working on. But I think right now my favorite is probably, if I had to pick a single feature, it's probably everything that revolves around around animation and very specifically like what all the things you can do with the transform function. But it's because that's what I was working on yesterday. Tomorrow, you know, pick me a, you know, I might have a different answer. I think it's more the versatility of things you can do. And the, like, based on very simple things, or CSS shapes, I think is also super cool just because of the extra layer of, you know, of styling that it can open up and kind of take us out of everything a square world and actually give us other options than squares, which is nice.
That's actually one I was not familiar with, and I kind of agree with you. So I'm interested to go and look into that myself, I think, having round page layouts.
It's still square under the covers, but it pretends not to be, which is nice.
Well, laptop screens are essentially grids, unfortunately. Cool. So if people want to find more about the book, it's currently in the Early Access Program, and there's one introduction and then three chapters available to take a look at. That's on manning.com, Tiny CSS Projects. Probably easier just to search for it. I found it quite easily. If people want to find out more about the two of you, any contact details you want to share?
Me, the easiest is martine.dev. That's where you'll find all my stuff and latest shenanigans.
Cool.
And feel free to reach out to me on Twitter. So it's Michael Giron. It's just that as a Twitter handle, nice and easy. Always feel free to reach out and drop me a message.
Cool. Well, thanks very much for joining me, and good luck with the rest of the book. And that was my interview with Michael and Martine and their forthcoming book. So a couple of things from me. I think I mentioned this last time, I've restructured some of my videos. I'm working on a lot of pre-recorded videos at the moment. I'm working on one for Canonical and Kubernetes. I am working on one for Better Touch Tool after my learning live stream, which was confusing way of mentioning that I had a learning live stream about Better Touch Tool, and I'm now working on a post video where I look at more of that. I'm also working on a video for an e-reader I've been playing with for a little while, one I bought, and quite a few other things in progress as well. I've got a lot of videos in progress, but they take a little bit of time to put together. And the other learning live stream I had recently was Bun, the JavaScript runtime to replace NPM and Yarn. Or is it? There was a little bit of a mixed opinion on that, but have a watch. These are reinvigorating my live streams where I just learn something on my own and then maybe turn it into a video later. So they're up there already. And I think that's going to be it from me for now. I keep promising lots of things coming soon. And this connects a little bit to what I said earlier about getting to a point where I'm going to change what I'm doing a little bit and have a bit more time for some other projects and some creative projects especially. So a lot of things that are very close to completion will get completed very quickly soon. TM. But until then, thank you very much for joining me. And I'll see you on the next show. Thanks for joining me, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the show. Find out more about me at chrischinchilla.com, where you can find show notes, sign up for my newsletter, and find all of my writing, games, work, and video links. There's also details on how to get in touch with me. And if you want to get even closer to what I do, join my Discord server for behind-the-scenes discussions and helping me produce my shows and work.